This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Wherever she is, the actor Jennifer Lewis tends to steal the show.
Look at y'all, Vivian girl, you are glowing.
For the last four decades, she's made a name for herself on stage, in films, and on television. And she's known for playing some very strong women, not unlike herself. Right now, she's playing the CEO of a home shopping network on the new Showtime series, I Love That For You.
Do I have suggestion box on my forehead?
Great. Everybody excited? Good. Me too.
Lewis's new memoir is called Walking in My Joy. And she recently spoke with New Yorker contributor Michael Shulman.
So my colleague Kalalia and I jumped on Zoom to talk with Ms. Lewis. I was in my home office. She was in her living room in L.A. with flowers, and she was beautifully made up for a photo shoot.
Okay, we are recording.
Recording? Michael, right. You're recording?
And just over her shoulder was this beautiful white grand piano.
All right. Have fun.
Thank you, baby.
I'm here if you need anything.
Okay, pumpkin.
Okay.
We had a great conversation. Heads up, as she tends to do, she used a lot of salty language. It's what she does best. It's great to meet you. Can you, first of all, you have a beautiful home. Is that what I'm looking at?
Darling, I have a beautiful home. Yes, you are. You're looking at my home.
Oh, Kalalia wants me to remind you to hold the phone.
Oh, bitch, ain't nobody gonna hold no phone for no whole fucking hour. All right, I'm here now. She get on my nerve. I can't stand her. That's why I gave her a lot of compliments. I knew she'd be trouble.
Jennifer, I read your book, Walking in My Joy. Really enjoyed it. And everyone always talks about how you're known as the mother of Black Hollywood because of all these incredible mother roles you've played to people like Tupac Shakur and Whitney Houston and you were Will Smith's aunt on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. It made me more curious about your own mother. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what she was like.
Oh my God, my mother was one of the most dramatic women that ever lived. Jesus, full of rage, full of madness, but determination. My mother was an alpha female, darling. That's where I got it from. You can imagine the woman that raised me. My mother damn near cut a man's arm off when I was 10 years old with a Coke bottle. Come on!
What happened?
His name was Jelly Bean. Do I have to say anything else?
I mean, please do.
It was a boyfriend. She was an alpha. She was a gangster. She could have been Al Capone's sister. Dorothy Mae Lewis. She took no shit from no one. She had 7 babies to raise. I was the baby. By the time I came along, she was exhausted. So I didn't get the kind of attention I thought I should have gotten. So I spent my entire life going, see me, see me, see me. Well, you see me now, don't you? Go, go, on, Jenny. Everybody see me now. I got my star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Hey, you want to hear a song? You want a song in your podcast?
Absolutely.
Hold on. Here's the song about my star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, Michael. I got a claim, a claim, a claim, a claim, a claim, yes. I got my star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Yeah! I'm so happy, I'm walking in my joy, oh boy, oh boy. That's for you, Michael. There you go.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
Incredible. This reminds me of all those amazing viral videos you made during the 2016 election season. So those were all songs that you wrote, right?
I don't want nobody messing with me. I don't want nobody messing with me in these streets.
Why did you write that song in 2016?
So I wrote the song In These Streets about, it was basically about police brutality, them, you know, just randomly shooting our children, riding bicycles, jogging down the street. Come on, come on, y'all. And I get on this piano and I just start sort of screaming for justice. That's what I find myself doing. I'm screaming for justice. And when I write things like this, this was after Parkland. Our children shouldn't have to run. They should never, ever even see a gun. They should be somewhere having fun. Our children shouldn't have to run from bullets. You know, I get on the piano, and whatever's going on in the world, I scream. I scream for justice. I can't say it any other way. You know, that first book tour I did, I went into places like Flint. If I was doing a concert in Detroit, I went into the trenches of Flint. If I was doing a book signing in Fort Lauderdale, I went down to Parkland and spoke to the kids. We've got to just take care of what's right in front of you. What's in front of you?
But these videos you made, the political sort of gospel songs, they're also incredibly funny.
Ah, yeah. Here's the one, this one got everybody. I don't care who you are or where you work. Get your ass out and vote. This ain't the election to sit home and lurk. Get your ass out and vote. Get your ass out and vote. Get your ass out and vote. Okay, so it's just get your fucking ass out and vote. Just get out and vote, assholes.
Jennifer, can I ask, were you always like this? I mean, did you just come out of the womb just screaming, get out, get your ass out and vote? I mean, what were you like?
This is what I came out of the womb singing. You'll be swell. You'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Honey, I was Ethel Merman Jr. Okay? See, I'm bipolar, and I made a decision a long time ago at the height of AIDS. At the height of the AIDS epidemic, I had a nervous breakdown. A dear friend of mine, whom I respected, said, Jennifer, you need help. I said, are you insane? Girl, I'm Jennifer Lewis. I ain't nothing wrong with me. But of course there was. There was just too much death surrounding me. You know, they fell, they dropped like flies in the early 90s and late 80s. And I just didn't have the strength, Michael. I didn't know who I was. I was just clawing at the void of the unknown. What do I do with this talent? Who am I? Why was I made? All of those questions. And I had lost so many friends. I said, you know, Jenny, maybe you ought to change this up. I went into therapy, Michael. I stayed in for 20 years. But I did the work. I'll tell anybody anywhere. You got to do the work. You got to do your homework.
Did you worry at all that your sort of outrageous, outspoken persona would be compromised once you were treated?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, dear God. Oh, I fought my therapist for at least, I think it was 3 or 4 years, I would not take the medication. I was like, I'm not getting it. Are you insane? This edge that you call mania is what makes me.
Hmm.
And she tried to assure me that it would not stifle or mute my edge of my humor and my comedic timing and my the force of nature that I became in my youth.
And did you find that was true? I mean, how did you adjust to this new life of being treated instead of kind of coasting on the highs and then, you know, crashing into the lows?
Well, it's work. It's all about finding the balance. You know, when I first started taking medication, my sexual desire went away. Well, I knew I had to get kept for that shit. And I got dry mouth, and I didn't know what it was. I went to the dentist, and of course he asked me, did you just start a new medication? And I was like, right. He said, this is dry mouth. I was like, well, we're going to have to lower that milligram. So you have to have patience to treat mental disorder. You have to have patience. They know what they're doing now. And you have to trust. You have to, you know, work with your psychologist or your psychiatrist on what are your levels. You have to be honest. You have to bring everything to the table. And now I am in my skin, far from perfect, but I am aligned in what makes me happy. And when you have more years behind you than in front, you don't waste time. I want to leave something here before I go. And they only need to say one thing about me when I pass this plane. Jennifer Lewis had power, and she gave it back.
Jennifer, you do have such a powerful presence. It sounds like you always have. What effect has that had on your co-stars?
People didn't know what to do with me. They didn't. I know it sounds funny, sounds arrogant, but it's true. I am a force of nature. My first review in New York City in the New York Post was Hurricane Lewis hits New York. I was 22 years old.
What was that for?
Oh, just one of my club acts. That's where Bette Midler found me.
Right. And explain what you did with Bette Midler.
Well, I was one of her backup singers, and we were called the Harlettes. And I did the 1983 tour with Bette Midler called Detour and learned so much from her. I mean, we're still good friends today. She's been a big supporter of mine my entire career and believes in me. We did have a big fight when she cheated in Scrabble. She put down, she put down Zion and put the Z on a triple letter score. I said, I bet Zion is capitalized. She said, Jennifer. And so she put me in a headlock. Yeah. And then so I just smashed the Scrabble game.
No, Zion is a proper noun. You can't use that in Scrabble.
She knew it, but it was so good. Wouldn't you had put it down too? I love her. And she, you know, I learned a lot from her. I did. I studied her in the wings, honey. I wasn't backstage holding court. When Bette Midler was on stage, I was in the wings.
Jennifer, there's a part in your book that I really loved. I want to ask you about, you write about rage, and of course a lot of your characters, you're great at playing rage, just like, you know, you're great at dropping F-bombs, first of all, but certainly angry characters is one of your specialties. But you wrote about your own rage, and you say, "I built a house made of steel around my body so no one could ever tear me down. I had a deep fear that to lose my anger meant to invite weakness in to replace it. I got into the horrible habit of walking through the world thinking I was protected by armor so thick that nothing could get in. Unfortunately, nothing could get out either." That's so compelling. I'm just curious about how you think about, you know, even political rage, performing rage, as something that you've sort of experienced, but are tempering it in your own life so that you're not hiding behind it.
Well, if you walk in your joy on purpose, as best you can, when all that other horror comes, you'll have something to balance it. That's how I get through it. You see, in my business, we rehearse, and then we're fabulous. So, Jenny, how about you practice a new behavior? Do it with all you have, instead of waking up depressed like you did for the first 30 years of your life. How about you learn how to get up another way? How about you not do one leg at a time? How about today you just jump out of there? Go on, Jenny. Do it. You got to talk to yourself. You got to make sure you're doing something you love to do every second of your life, because it could be the last.
Well, Jennifer, this has been an absolute delight. I feel like I've just experienced the best of Hurricane Jennifer. And you've just cracked me up.
Oh, good. I'm glad. You got me on a really good day, too. I got the New York Times coming in here. I got to pull it up.
Well, that's why you look so stylish, isn't it? Not for our radio show?
Yeah.
That was Jennifer Lewis talking with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman. Her memoir, Walking in My Joy, is out next week. And you can watch her in the TV series, I Love That For You. It's on Showtime right now. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. From the moment Donald Trump was elected, threats of violence from the extreme right, from white nationalists, anti-Semites, all kinds of groups, ramped up considerably. Law enforcement experts cited Trump's inflammatory rhetoric, even his celebration of tough guy violence at his rallies, as inspirations. Trump, of course, was defeated in 2020, but he is still very much with us. January 6th was an attempt at an open insurrection, and the threats have hardly faded with his retreat to Florida.
and when FBI agents raided Mar-a-Lago recently to secure highly sensitive documents, the threats came again, fast and furious. Some on the far right compare the FBI to the Gestapo, and they're invoking the term civil war. An armed assailant attacked an FBI office in support of Trump, and he was killed trying to escape. At the same time, much of the leadership of the Republican Party is afraid to denounce Trump or the fever that he's inspired. More and more Americans now are beginning to acknowledge that democracy itself is in peril. So today I'd like to revisit a conversation I had earlier this year with Barbara F. Walter. It seems even more relevant today than it was then, which is really saying something. Walter is a political scientist whose recent book is called How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. She studied political violence for the CIA, and she says that the possibility of real civil unrest, even civil war, is on some level very real. Now, there have been a lot of books about how democracies die, the twilight of democracy, and I think that readers who want to get it, and the audience that wants to get it, gets it. Now you're telling us something even worse. That there's a possibility of a civil war in this country. What does that mean?
It means that the U.S. has the risk factors that we know tend to lead to civil war. And let me explain that. So I've been studying civil wars for the last 30 years outside the United States in places like Iraq and Libya and Afghanistan, Mozambique, Northern Ireland. I haven't looked at the United States because until recently, there's been no reason to do that. And one of the things that we've learned is that even though these countries are different, the same factors tend to emerge again and again in the lead up to civil war. And then over the last 5 years, I started looking at my own country. And I started to see these factors emerge not only here, but emerge at a surprisingly rapid rate.
Well, what are the crucial factors that make you believe that the United States, which has always thought of itself as exceptional and the oldest democracy on earth and many other cliches that we could list and examine, what has changed so that we are vulnerable to this?
So back in 2017, I was invited to be on a task force run by the U.S. government, and it's called the Political Instability Task Force. And it's been around since...
This is part of this. This is a CIA effort?
Yeah, it's a CIA effort. And so what the task force did is initially they sat around a table and they brainstormed about all the commonsensical things that these experts thought could potentially lead to instability and violence. And the first and most important one was something that we call anocracy. Anocracy is a fancy term that political scientists give to governments that are neither fully democratic nor fully autocratic. There's something in between. You could think about these as partial democracies. And that was surprising. It turns out that full democracies rarely have civil wars. Full autocracies rarely have civil wars. It's the ones that are in between that are particularly at risk. The second factor is in these anocracies, if their populations begin to organize along racial, ethnic, or religious lines and form parties which then seek to gain political power in order to exclude everyone else. We call those ethnic factions. And so when we looked around the world and we saw countries that had these two factors, they were put on a watch list just to see what, you know, these are countries that we have to look out for because they're unlikely to remain stable in the next few years.
Just, so to, be clear, just to be clear, the CIA was interested in models of foreign countries that fall into civil war.
The CIA is legally not allowed to look at the United States. We never, ever talked about the United States. That was absolutely verboten. So this was my own personal decision that here I am. I've studied civil wars for 30 years. I'm on this task force. I know about this model. And this is information that I thought the American public should have.
Now, you map out
in historical terms and in political science terms, a kind of map of the course of American democracy since 1776. Yeah. And beginning mainly with the election of Andrew Jackson, the United States becomes solidly a democracy. And it obviously falls back in the period that leads up to the Civil War and carries us through the Civil War, and then recovers in, I believe, 1877, if I remember right.
Has
some bad moments in the mid-60s, but it has never been as bad in 200 years as it was on January 6th and is today. Explain that.
Yeah, so the United States until January 6th, 2021, was considered the world's longest standing democracy. It was downgraded to an anocracy after the January 6th insurrection, and Switzerland is now considered the longest standing democracy. America's democratic decline began...
Forgive me for interrupting, but who's doing the downgrading? Is there a rating service? How is that done?
It's a big data set called the Polity data set. It's run out of the Center for Systemic Peace. It's a nonprofit that studies not just democracies around the world. It analyzes all countries around the world, whether autocratic or democratic, and it gives them a rating between negative 10, most autocratic, to positive 10, most democratic.
So that rating system, that Moody's of democracy, if you will, is telling us that the United States is no longer a democracy?
The way to really think about it is it's a partial democracy. So if we were to continue to become less democratic, if, for example, voting rights were suppressed even more, if we did have a situation where one party tried to overturn the results of election, we would certainly be downgraded even further, and we would become at even greater risk of political violence.
Your book begins with a very dramatic moment, which was a group of right-wing radicals, white supremacists, who were furious with many things, but they were hatching a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan. And this was a plot that was thankfully overturned, and there were arrests and all the rest. But you clearly begin your book with that incident as a kind of harbinger of many such incidents that could be in the offing. You know, we saw on the Capitol the three percenters, we saw all kinds of groups, Proud Boys and the rest. What is coalescing out in the country that gives you the feeling that civil war is possible? And what would that civil war look like? Obviously, it's not going to be a matter of Gettysburg and Antietam and 1862 and battlefields, but what does civil war mean? And what gives you the sense that it will happen?
Yeah, what I see happening is what we've seen happening in other countries. And here in the United States, we're in the midst of a massive transformation of our country from being a country that's a white majority to being a country that's non-white majority. By about 2045, the United States will be a minority white country. That's a fact. And what we are witnessing is a subset of the white population, which is unwilling to accept this. And that also fits what we've seen historically. We know that the groups that tend to start civil wars are not the poorest groups. They're not the immigrant groups. They are the groups that were once dominant, but are in decline. They either had power or they know they're losing power. And they believe that the country is rightfully theirs, and they are willing to use violence to stop it. And so what we're going to see is a different type of civil war. And you've seen this in other countries as well. Something that's more decentralized. It's fought by a large number of smaller militias, paramilitary groups. Sometimes they work together, sometimes they don't work together. And they're using unconventional tactics, the tactics of the weak against the strong, guerrilla warfare, terrorism. So a bomb here, a mass killing there, targeting infrastructure, targeting crowded spaces, targeting civilians. That's the type of civil war we're more likely to see here. And in fact, it will look more similar to what the IRA was doing in Northern Ireland, or even what Hamas has done in Israel.
I think you're suggesting those analogies as analogies of tactics, not one of types of struggles.
Yeah.
But it seems to me, though, that kind of violence is not foreign to American history. And we don't have to just go back to Timothy McVeigh or Waco or the rest. We can go back much farther of other kinds of terror. You could even say that Tulsa in the early part of the century was a white supremacist act of massive terrorism in Oklahoma.
Yeah. Or the Ku Klux Klan. They pursued terror as a method.
But we didn't frame that as civil war. Why are we framing this as potential civil war?
So one way to think about this is to think about it as an insurgency. The CIA actually has made publicly available a manual that they put together. The last version was the 2012 version. It's called A Guide to Insurgency, and people can get it online. And it's really interesting to read. It outlines what the CIA sees as three stages of insurgency. So stage one is the organizational phase, when you start to see extremists get together and start to organize. Stage two is when they start to form militias, they start to form military arms. There might be, a very isolated, but government officials view that attack as isolated, and they don't see it yet as part of a broader movement. And the open insurgency stage is when you start to see a consistent set of attacks. We are at the second stage, where militias have formed. They've exploded since the Obama era. And they are arming themselves, they are training, and we have had a few violent incidences. And the question all the experts on insurgency were asking about January 6th was, is this the start of the third stage, the open insurgency stage, or is this really still this very sporadic, still isolated violence of stage two? And I think we haven't hit that third stage yet. But again, the militias are still there. They are still organizing. And I think most troubling, they are increasingly coming to believe that violence is their only option.
Political scientist Barbara F. Walter. She's the author of How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. Our conversation was recorded early this year and will continue in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In January, a year after the violent failed coup of January 6th, I spoke with the political scientist Barbara F. Walter, who has studied insurgency and political violence for the CIA. There was one moment when it seemed that the Republican Party leadership was going to stand up after looking into the abyss and stand up for democracy. And that was the moment when Mitch McConnell in the well of the Senate denounced Donald Trump. And if you were naive, perhaps, you thought for one fleeting second that this might have an effect, or at least create a kind of serious conflict within the Republican Party. It disappeared within a day or two. Yeah. McCarthy as well.
Yeah.
And in the end, McConnell didn't vote to convict. 66% of the House caucus voted to reject Biden, his presidency. It seems that the Republican Party leadership is responsible for a civil war scenario is as much as the radicalized base is, no?
Well, it's kind of a chicken or egg situation. What comes first? Politicians' number one priority is to win office and to stay in office, and they need the support of their voters, to their constituents, to do that. So they're going to reflect the desire of their constituents. And much of the Republican Party, the voters are still enthralled with Trump, and politicians are going to reflect this. On the other hand, they are taking measures to play to an increasingly radical base. If you're gerrymandering your districts, what you're doing is you're creating heavily Republican districts, and you're forcing Republican candidates to fight out in the primaries with another Republican, and it's usually the more extreme Republican who wins. And the reason for that is that more passionate members of parties tend to turn out in the primaries. They're both responsible.
Let's talk about the nature of potential violence in such a second civil war. You write, whether or not the United States will find itself in a security dilemma depends on whether those on the left, liberals, minorities, city dwellers, decide that they should also arm themselves.
Yeah.
Why is that the case?
Okay, so here's the strategic dilemma. If you're an accelerationist on the right, you want civil war. By definition, you're extreme. Most people on the right are not as extreme as you are. You have to convince average citizens to support your cause. Otherwise, you're not going to succeed, right? So what you often see happening are these ethnic entrepreneurs or violent entrepreneurs. Those are the ones who want to instigate. They want to start a fight. If you're Slobodan Milosevic in Yugoslavia, right? And you want to gain control of Yugoslavia, but in order to do that, you have to defeat the Croats so that they don't become independent. You've got to convince average Serbs to support your cause. But most average citizens don't want war. So what these violence entrepreneurs often do is they provoke some sort of violent attack from the other side, because they need hard evidence to show their own population that what they're saying is in fact true. And so they'll prod or they'll provoke until there is some response. And then they use that to say, you know, look, everything we've been telling you is true. You better arm now or you're going to be in trouble.
We also know that the United States has incredibly powerful and sophisticated law enforcement and the world's largest military. And isn't it stand to reason that once the FBI or law enforcement put its collective mind to both surveilling and dealing with this problem, that yes, there would be incidents and it would be awful. There's no underestimating that. But it wouldn't be a matter of civil war.
It would be this type of insurgency, which for people who study conflict, we would consider that a civil war. But to get to your question, those groups in the United States who are preparing for civil war have thought about your question, and they understand how powerful the U.S. military is, and they've seen what the FBI is able to do. After the Timothy McVeigh bombing in Oklahoma City, the FBI was incredibly effective in infiltrating militias and basically neutralizing them. And so they've learned from that. And they talk a lot about a strategy called leaderless resistance. And in fact, there's a book, it's considered the Bible of the far right in terms of how to fight this 21st century civil war here in the United States. It's called The Turner Diaries.
It's been around for a while.
It's been around for a while. You used to be able to buy it on Amazon until January of 2021. In fact, I bought a copy in December of 2020. And when I bought it on Amazon, Amazon recommended a whole series of other white supremacist books that I might want to read as well.
That's great news. Yeah,
it was great news. So the algorithm clearly identified that I would want to go deeper down this subject. But leaderless resistance is this, it's like cell warfare, this notion that if you can create 1,000 little fighting cells in the United States, that's very, very hard for even a powerful government to put down.
Now, because we don't want to close with absolute gloom and foreboding or even self-fulfilling prophecy about a potential second civil war, you look to the experience of South Africa, of all places, as a prime example of how a country avoided a civil war despite all the complications of the transfer from apartheid to something else. Now, it's always hard to analyze a thing that hasn't happened. But what do you think kept South Africa from slipping into civil war? And what's the analogy with the United States?
Yeah. South Africa is a fantastic case. So back in the 80s, if you were to ask civil war experts what country was most likely to experience a civil war, every single one of them would have said South Africa. And it would have been hard to argue with them. This was the time when the apartheid government was doubling down. You saw increasing protests by the Black majority, and the government was responding with more and more violence. And of course, the Soweto killings, where the government went in and just killed 100 plus children, was just a culmination of that. So people thought, wow, you know, here you have the apartheid regime. They not only are they refusing to reform in any way, but they are just doubling down with violence and repression. And then the government shifted and Botha was replaced by de Klerk, and de Klerk very quickly agreed to let Mandela out of prison and negotiate with him about a peaceful transfer of political power. So the white minority peacefully handed over majority control to the Black majority. And so the question is, okay, why would you ever do this? And that's a puzzle, because usually the group that's in power, especially if it's a minority, holds on to power for dear life, because they know if they reform, they know if they compromise, they're going to be shut out of power forever. And yet that didn't happen in South Africa. And a big reason it didn't happen is because the white business community, white business elites, finally broke away from the apartheid regime. And they said, we are not going to support this anymore.
But carry that out to a U.S. example. Who's de Klerk in this analogy? Who's Mandela? And how does this apply to the United States in any way?
That's a great question.
In the American map, in the American situation, what moves have to be made on all sides so that we are not staring once more into the abyss and then leaping in?
Yeah. So the de Klerk in the United States case is Republican leadership. It would be people like McConnell. McConnell is a key player here because he keeps the Senate in lockstep. So it would be Republican leadership that is from the federal level to the state level that currently is doing everything possible to cement minority rule at, you know, at various levels.
The logic here is you're asking the Republican Party leadership to sign its own suicide pact in terms of power. In other words, it's the nature of politicians to hold on to, grasp, and enhance power. You're asking them to do the opposite.
It's not a suicide pact at all, right? The United States, our system is based, is a two-party system. And, you know, if the Republican Party continues to cater only to white voters, that's their own suicide pact that they're making with themselves. They don't have to do that. In fact, in many ways, and Republican leadership back in the 2012 elections, they came out and they said, we must expand our tent. We must begin to woo Latinos. Latinos, in some respects, are a natural constituency for the Republican Party. They tend to be socially conservative. They were there for the picking for the Republican Party. It's the Republican Party that chose not to try to attract that growing subset of the American population. And of course, they didn't do that because it's very hard to cater to the far right, which includes many whites who are racist and include Latinos. And so they're in this bind where at some point they're going to have to let the far right go if they want to continue to operate as a healthy party here in the United States.
Barbara Walter, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much, David.
Barbara F. Walter's new book is called How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. She's a professor at the University of California, San Diego, and a co-director of the website Political Violence at a Glance. The war in Ukraine has been raging for 6 long months, and that's longer than almost anyone expected when Russian tanks first rolled toward Kiev in February. Those early days of the war are the setting for the story The Muddle, which was featured on the New Yorker's fiction podcast this month. Here's author Sana Krasikov reading the opening passages.
Shura was trying to reach Alyona and Oleg, first over Skype and WhatsApp, then Facebook, on which Alyona kept an account she barely used. It should not have been so hard to get hold of them. Alyona had not posted recently, but she checked her messages. Shura could see that. Maybe she thought Shura was being dramatic. Hadn't she always thought so? With her digital silence, Alyona was making a big show of her own calm, doubling down on her refusal to treat anything as a catastrophe. Well, goody for her, Shura thought, and shut her laptop. If Alyona wasn't panicked, why should she be? It was day 3, and there were still no Russian boots in central Kyiv. There was the battle for the Hamostyl airport, and a rocket had crashed into a building in Abalon. But that was not near where Alyona and Oleg lived, in the Shevchenkovsky district. From the security of her own house in Croton on Hudson, Shura tried not to think about the last conversation she'd had with Alyona. It had been a rather unpleasant chat, but now there was a war on and it seemed unnecessary to be holding a grudge, one of the very few they'd had in their 60-odd year friendship. On day 5, a reply came over Skype. We're alive. 2 words in a pale blue bubble. It should have taken the tension out of her lungs, but it only agitated Shura more. She'd expected a bit more emotiveness. Did they have groceries? Were they spending nights in their building's basement or in the metro? We're alive, the bare minimum. She would write back, Shura decided, but not yet. She dialed Pavel's number in Winnipeg instead. All right, Pavel, she said briskly. What is going on with your parents? They're waiting it out in the apartment, She gathered from his voice that he'd understood her meaning. Not, are they okay, but what is wrong with those two? Why aren't they on their way to Winnipeg? Shura could hear Pavel exhale. He'd likely been asked this a dozen times by now. Have they become patriots all of a sudden? She said, unable to resist. But he wasn't hurt, having some of his own bitterness to shed. Last time she was here, Mama said she didn't find Winnipeg cozy. Meaning what? It's too Canadian? Too Ukrainian. Oh, for heaven's sake. Oleg, to be sure, was Russian, the son of a colonel. But Alyona was Ukrainian, on both sides, as she'd proudly told Shura when they were girls. Her father's family was from the Vinnytsia area, her mother's from Donbass. Pavel said, Mama, I understand better than I do him. She's always been under his thumb. But I think he'd rather spend his old age living on canned tushonka than accept help from me. Pavel had been more of a joker when he'd arrived in Winnipeg 20 years ago. The long shift into a Canadian had turned him, Shura thought, more earnest and a touch more righteous. Oh, Pavel. She sensed that he would tell her more if she egged him on a little. But she hesitated, not wanting to give the impression that she was disparaging his mother. So what's their situation with groceries? No worries about that. Last time we spoke, she was making veal the French way.
Sana Krasikov reading her story, The Muddle. You can hear the rest on the New Yorker podcast, The Writer's Voice, or read it in the August 15th issue of the magazine. That's our episode for today, but before we go, I'm going to say three really bad words. Not obscene words, just three lousy words I never wanted to say on the radio. Goodbye, Ave Carrillo. Ave has been our senior producer since the day we launched in 2015. There's not one thing you've ever heard on this program that wasn't touched by Ave's intelligence and sensitivity and made a lot better by her in ways small and large. She's worked magic often enough that we thought it was just the way things worked. And we're really going to miss her. So goodbye, Ave. We can't wait to hear your new show. I'm David Remnick. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofenin Putubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.